Welcome back to Not Just Paleo. I'm your host, Evan Brand. If you're new to the show, welcome. I'm a board-certified holistic nutritionist, a certified functional medicine practitioner, and a nutritional therapy practitioner. And today, we're talking with a new friend of mine, Dr. Thomas Cowan, who I heard about through Ben Greenfield. Ben's one of the only other podcasters. Daniel Vitalis is another great one. I don't listen to too many podcasts, but them too, they have some really cool guests. And so I checked out Ben's episode. I'm like, man, I got to reach out and interview Dr. Cowan. So he's been part of the Weston A. Price Foundation and helped to co-found it. There's many other things that he's done, which we'll get into. He's a MD. He's a medical doctor who really puts a huge emphasis on good, healthy fats, good nutrition, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get into all that real shortly. As you may have heard or seen across the internet, the Adrenal Reset Summit is officially coming November 7th. So that's coming up really darn quick. My friend Dr. Alan Christensen and I are hosting the event. There's 32 speakers, and you can get access to the talks as soon as they start. You can go register right this second at adrenalresetsummit.com. If you just Google Adrenal Reset Summit, you should be able to find it as well. Or if you go to my website, notjustpaleo.com, you'll see the little banner and you can go register for the event for free. You're going to get three free bonuses. You're going to get a chapter of my Stress Solutions book. You're going to get Alan's Fiber Guide and Dr. Isabella Wentz, her Hashimoto's Guide. So that's at adrenalresetsummit.com. Enjoy this episode. Dr. Tom Cowan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes, sir. Well, talk us through some of your history as a medical doctor. When you came out of medical school, how different was your mindset on health compared to the practice that you do today?
Not that different, actually. I mean, hopefully I've learned a few things in 40 years, and I don't know if I'm smarter, but I'm certainly more experienced. And my mindset was, I'd say, very different than my peers and the conventional medical community. But I would say it's an interesting question. If I had to summarize the difference between a 28-year-old Tom Cowan and a 60-year-old, I thought this was going to be easier than it is. I thought if you just tell people how to eat and how to live and, you know, some natural medicines, everything was going to be easy and good. And it turns out it's not so easy like that. Life is complicated and, you know, we live in a hugely stressful, toxic environment. And, you know, the people who come to me have the worst of the worst health problems. You know, nobody comes to me for normal colds and flus and stuff. So these are like people with lupus or ulcerative colitis or cancer or heart disease that haven't been helped with, you know, anything else. And it's not like, oh, do this, you're fine, see you later, end of story. You got to work at it.
Absolutely. So you're the end of the rope for a lot of people, you're saying.
So, yeah, sort of. That's it.
Yeah, I understand. So what's the hardest part about it? What do you think is the hardest part of getting people? Is it the compliance aspect, or is it just factoring in the 24/7 stress that may not have existed in the way that it existed back when you first graduated, or what's so different or hard?
You know, it's not so much compliance. People say that all the time, and this is kind of a smart alecky thing to say, but I don't really have so many compliance issues. Partly because I figure if you charge people enough there and they want to come to you, they've already decided they're going to do what you say.
Right, I agree.
in some ways, I don't worry about compliance. I believe people should have the freedom to do what they think is best for them, no matter what that is, really. And if they don't want to do it, they don't want to do it. It's not a compliance issue. I think it's a personal choice. So it's just that, you know, when you've lived a life for 50 years and you've got, you know, root canals and you've had 20 vaccines and you've been treated with immunosuppressive drugs for 10 years and, You don't have the money to get the best food, and you live in a place where the food isn't available, and your wife is leaving you or whatever. You know, you can't just say, well, eat good food, you'll be fine. It's just not quite that easy. So you have this whole life history that you have to unravel, and it's, you know, it's a tough gig. Absolutely. Not that it can't be done, and people get help for sure, but you know, it's naive to think that when you get to be, you know, 60 and you've lived a life of smoking that you can with and now you have you're looking at heart attacks and stuff. You can just say, oh, here, do a little exercise. You'll be fine. I mean, you have to do a little exercise or maybe more, and you have to be rigorous about what you do. But it's still tough. It's been a long time for a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well said. So in terms of nutrition, I mean, obviously, that's an important piece. It's kind of the foundation that has to be put in place. But what are some of these aspects of healing, or what are some of these other pieces to the puzzle that you hit on hard? Your practice, fourfold healing, makes me curious about what those components are.
Well, certainly diet is key. And, you know, I'm a sort of a schemer, or I make things try to be as clear and simple as I can. And I think what you're asking is, you know, what do I tell people about diet? And is that?
Yeah, that's a good starting place. Absolutely.
So the first thing I would say is the first rule of diet is we're talking about a quality-based diet here, not a quantity-based diet. So whatever food it is, one has to ask the question, what is the healthiest way to obtain that chicken, carrot, apricot, whatever? And so eating poor quality food will get you nowhere. And it's been a continual source of amazement to me that a doctor could think that you can eat, you know, sick chickens and produce a healthy person. And so that's, to me, nonsense. So basically, the way one answers that question simply enough is try to understand what the way that food source wants to live. And I know there's some, I guess you call it anthropomorphizing here. Like, how do I know which way a cow likes to live? Well, I guess I'm guessing, but my guess is cows like to roam around in the pastures and eat grass. And if you stick them in a confinement and feed them cardboard or dead cow parts, they will get sick and produce sick milk and meat. So that's how I decide. You know, carrots like to have rich biodynamic or organic compost. I also think that plants like to grow with other plants. You know, it may sound funny, but it gives them something to look at and something to smell. And they get less diseases. They're less stressed. I mean, if you have a field of 100 acres of almond trees, they're going to get stressed and not like it. So you're talking about growing food in whatever food that is in the way that's best for that animal. I mean, these are living beings. And so we have grass-fed, you know, meat and wild fish and pastured chickens and pastured eggs and, you know, organic biodynamically mixed culture seeds and nuts. If we're going to eat grains, we eat perennial heirloom old-fashioned grains that are soaked and sprouted. You know, lots of different vegetables. You know, I talk about eating 120 different vegetables a year and 15 a day. All biodynamically, organically, or wild vegetables or perennial vegetables. It's all about diversity. And to me, that's the sort of basis of my diet.
Excellent. So people are wondering, what's Dr. Cowan going to eat for lunch and dinner today?
You know, so I pretty much have a kind of a threefold scheme, which is I eat full fat animal products pretty much at every meal. So I just had breakfast about an hour ago, and I had two eggs with the vegetable powders that we make. So that gives me about seven different vegetables and eggs cooked in a combination of grass-fed ghee and organic coconut oil. And then I had soup with soup broth that we made from pastured chicken bones, to which I sauteed a leek and a carrot and Malabar spinach and Okinawan longevity spinach, sauteed that up, put the broth in it, and then put sauerkraut that we made ourselves from heirloom cabbage on top of that. And then I had a little bit of fresh pomegranate arils, I think you call them, that was my breakfast.
Excellent. Excellent. Have you thought far ahead to what's for lunch or dinner yet?
Dinner will be, it's the same, some sort of probably wild fish and like a sweet potato baked with some coconut oil and our pepper salt, which is a really good combination. And then I was going to make cauliflower and greens for the vegetable part.
That's excellent.
We always have some fermented stuff, and we always put some of our vegetable powders on to add diversity as well.
Sure. Sounds great. I want to talk about supplements a little bit and then transition and talk about your new book that's coming out, Human Heart, Cosmic Heart. In terms of adaptogens, which I see a lot of different adaptogen products on your site here, how have adaptogens, just curious because I love adaptogens myself, how have adaptogens played a role in you as a clinician, but just you personally, your personal experience using them?
I can't say I've used them for myself so much. Maybe I should have, but you know, there's an interesting saying in Chinese medicine that every disease needs to treat the adrenal gland, which, so when you're talking about adaptogens, you're talking about some substance, usually an herb or some nutrient that supports adrenal function. And the adrenal gland is where you process stress. So, you know, every illness has a stress component. Even if it wasn't that you had a stressful life, just being sick is by definition stressful. So every Chinese formula has some adrenal component, whether it's licorice or ginseng or something. So I tend to use those as well. The other one, in some ways, the medicine that I talk about for the heart called strophanthus, which is a plant extract, that could be called an adaptogen. In fact, in some ways, it could be called the premier adaptogen because it supports a very specific function of the adrenal gland, which, and so in a sense, I guess I use that. I mean, I use it for all my heart patients. So that is one way of using an adaptogen.
That's excellent. Do you care to spell that for us? Because that's one that is a tricky one to spell, and I guarantee no one has ever heard or even seen this product.
So the plant, the way it works is the plant is an African vine that was supposedly originally, quote, discovered, not that he was the first one, by, you know, the Livingston guy who sort of mapped Africa. And the vine is called strophanthus, strophanthus. It has an active ingredient in it, which is called, in German, it's called G-strophanthine, strophanthin. I think I got that right. And in the United States, that same chemical is called wabaine, which is a fun thing to say, O-U-A-B-A-I-N. And it used to be a conventional pharmaceutical drug in the 40s and 50s in this country. People, clinicians, cardiologists gave people with fast heart rates, atrial fib, or heart, quote, weakness. They gave them intravenous strophanthine or wabaine extracts. And it was the main treatment in Germany and some other places in Europe for heart, quote, weakness, given IV and then orally for 30, 40 years. And then through some, there's some history of why it came out of favor, which has a little bit of a kind of sordid side, but anyways, it did, and then people forgot about it.
Interesting. Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because when you read about it, which I'll probably butcher the pronunciation. The is it Wabane? Wabane?
Wabane.
Wabane, okay. So when you read about it, just online, the general talk about it is kind of in a negative light. You know, they say, oh, it's a toxic substance. They used it traditionally as like an arrow poison in Eastern Africa for hunting and warfare. But basically, right. The idea is the dose makes the poison with this. Is that the best way to say it?
Yes. It has different effects depending on the dose, and used in the right dose, it has effects on the heart that no other substance does, which are absolutely crucial for treating people who are at risk of or having heart attacks or susceptible to that sort of thing. And the research on the proper use of Strophanthus wabane is, I would say, incontrovertible that it's probably the most effective therapy that we have for treating heart disease.
That's incredible. So is this something that can be used acutely? Like, is this something that should be in a standard ambulance care kit?
Yes, if there was the proper preparation and the proper knowledge about how to use it, yes. We're a long way off from that.
Yeah.
But yes, it should be.
I figured. Okay, that's excellent. And there's a doctor, which you may be familiar with. I think the last name is Shroka. It's Sroka, Dr. Shroka. I'm not sure if it's...
Yeah, Knut Shroka.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
He's a friend of mine.
Excellent. I figured he was, because he's got a good article about this, too, and considers his substance a completely wasted opportunity for the medical field.
Yes. In fact, anybody who wants to know more about this whole theory of why we get heart attacks, which is different than the normal theory, which I write about in my book, and why wabane strophanthus is, in a sense, the perfect medicine for treating the real reason we get heart attacks, needs to go to Knut's website, which is heartattacknew.com.
That's excellent. So can we talk about that a little bit? Heart disease is, you know, depending on what statistics you look at, some of the biggest impact on our economic health as a society. I mean, people just dying in droves of heart disease. Where does all this root from? You know, if you could, maybe it's not this easy, this is a complex situation, but if you could kind of draw a web or draw a map, what are the biggest pieces of this that are the issue? Why is this such a huge epidemic? Is diet the biggest piece? And if so, what are the other ones?
If you would permit me to change the question a little bit.
Sure.
Because the problem here is we have a theory about heart disease, which, you know, the book that I wrote has three parts. It's basically one part is about my story, and the other part is about what the heart does, which is that it's not a pump. It doesn't pump the blood. And that leads to a whole lot of other insights. And we can get into that or not. But the third part, which is what we're talking about now, and in some ways the part that may be of most interest to people, is what causes heart attacks? Because in order to answer your question about what are the reasons people get heart attacks, we obviously have to know what causes heart attacks. And in order to know that, it's always best to start with what doesn't cause heart attacks, because we have a common theory in layman's terms and cardiology terms that everybody believes, maybe not everybody, but pretty much everybody. And what I'm saying in the book is that theory is wrong, and that has led us astray. And so if you want, I can start with why that theory is wrong.
Please do.
And that leads into what theory is right, and that leads into what to do about it.
Absolutely. Sounds like a plan.
So everybody knows, if you go, you know, I tell people, if you get the next 100 people walk down the street, or 100 of the cardiologists and internists, and you get them together and say, what causes heart attacks? Everybody would say the same thing, which is you have these four major coronary arteries which bring blood flow to your heart. and they get blocked with plaque and the blood can't get through, and the part downstream from the heart dies. That's as simple as that. Now, over the last number of decades, we've had huge debates, you know, Dean Ornish and whatever, paleo and low fat and everybody, and cholesterol, as to why we get plaques. You know, why does this atherosclerosis happen? Why we get plaques? But everybody agrees that it's the plaque impeding the blood flow in the heart, in these coronary arteries. That's what causes heart attacks, right? Everybody knows that. Now, about 15 years ago, I was, for the first time, introduced to the fact that that may not be true. And so here's the reasoning on that. Number one, if you think about this, and I can ask this in a series of questions so you can think along with me. You say, well, so what's causing the plaque must be something in the blood, right? So, right, it must be something in the blood. That's why we give lipid-lowering medicines, or you change your diet because you're trying to affect something in the blood.
Sure.
So if there's something in the blood, then it must be in all the arteries in the body, because it's the same blood everywhere. Which means that you must get, if you get plaque in one artery, you must get plaque in other arteries as well. Which means you must get plaque in this artery to the spleen, called the splenic artery, the artery to the liver, called the hepatic artery, the femoral artery, the carotid artery, and the coronary artery. All those get plaque if the conditions are right in the blood. So then I ask people the next question, which is, how many people do you know who've had spleen attacks or liver attacks or foot attacks or kidney attacks? And I don't know what your answer is, but everybody I've ever asked said they've never heard of anybody.
Definitely not. Definitely not.
Never. Now, how many people have you heard have heart attacks? I mean, a lot. Dick
yeah.
Cheney, Bill Clinton, Aunt Bessie, you know, everybody. Millions, hundreds of thousands of years. So the question is, if they all get plaque, why do just heart and brain get attacks, not the other organs? So that was the first thing. The next thing is, I actually started to do the research on the percentage of people at autopsy who have blockages in an artery who die from a heart attack. You would think it was 100%. I mean, that's the theory. It turns out, because in the 40s and 50s, when heart disease started, you know, becoming more prominent, the cardiologists did not agree with this heart attack blocked artery theory. They said, no, that's not right. Because all the arteries get blocked. Why is it just the heart? So they did autopsies. And what they found was anywhere between a low of about 18% and a high of about 70% that had actual blockage of an artery leading to the part that killed them with the heart attack. So in other words, sometimes 80% of the people didn't have a blockage. And even at the maximum, it was 70%, which begs the question, why did those other 30% have a heart attack? Now, interestingly, the 18% were people who died immediately after a heart attack. And if you waited, say, 2 or 3 days, so you had a heart attack on Monday and then didn't die till Wednesday, that's when you got up to the 60, 70%. Which, what that suggests is that the blockage was a consequence of the heart attack, not the cause of the heart attack. In only something like 20% do you even find a blockage in the area that leads to the part that had a heart attack. And by the way, if you go to heartattacknew.com website, you can read these, you know, studies that go through that, and some of them are also posted on my website. So that's the main thing, is that theory doesn't agree with the autopsy findings of what happened. The final thing is, about 90% of the bypasses and stents in this country are done in the following scenario. And just think about this for a minute. Person comes in who's having some chest pain or shortness of breath or just doesn't feel well, 50-year-old guy, 60-year-old guy. So they go in, they do an angiogram where they put dye in his heart, and they say, oh, you have a 95% blockage in your left anterior descending or your circumflex, that we need to fix this right away with a stent or a bypass, or you're going to die.
Yep.
That's 90% of the people who come to me. Now, let's dissect that scenario a little bit. So we're talking about a guy who's got four coronary arteries, like most people. One of them, so 25% of his heart, has 95% blockage, which means basically no blood flow, right?
Right.
So if he has no blood flow, I had a guy came in a month ago. He walked up a 5-mile hike and didn't feel great, but he did it. How did that guy walk up 5 miles with 5% blood flow to his heart? Like, that's impossible. The next thing is, so you mean to tell me that if he blocks from 5% to what, 3%, that that's going to be the decisive and that's what's going to kill him? So it's that last 2% that's really going to kill him. That's why we're doing bypasses and stents. I don't know about you, but to me, that's ridiculous.
That sounds insane. The way that, the way you're articulating it makes perfect sense.
Right. If you've got 5% blood flow, you've got no blood flow. You've got no business walking up anything. You've got no business being alive, frankly, if that's the only place the blood flow comes from.
Right.
And if you block from 5% to 0%, that doesn't make any difference at all, which is why every study on bypasses, stents, and angioplasties, besides very acute situations, shows no long-term benefit. Because the theory makes no sense. And I don't know how much more clearly I can say this, but if you just think about it, it makes no sense at all.
It seems crazy. So let me ask you this then. I feel like I already know the answer, but I have to ask the question, why is that done? Why is that the standard of care? Is it education? Is it money? Is it both?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question, but let me just point out, so all this argument with Ornish and, you know, Pritikin and Paleo and about the plaques, I'm not saying plaque is good for you, but it's not the predominant factor in heart disease. So all that is in some ways misguided. Now, why did they do it? This happened in the 60s. And again, there was a huge controversy. That's why, and again, they're posted on my website, these autopsy studies, because that's the only way you can sort this out, did not show that this was the case. But that's when they were developing the coronary bypass, techniques. They had the lipid hypothesis that it was the cholesterol was what was forming these plaques, which, by the way, nobody believes that anymore. We now know there is no cholesterol essentially in those plaques. Plaques are not made from cholesterol; they're inflammatory debris. So even the plaque problem is not because of high fat diet. Like, they had some kind of crazy theory that if you ate butter, the butter would settle in your coronary arteries, which is, I mean, that's ludicrous. But anyways, I think they just had strategies that were lucrative that could do something about this, and you would get symptomatic relief, and they went with it.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, I don't know what was behind this, but that's the best I can figure.
Sure. This is amazing. So let's keep going with this then. What's the next part? You kind of had this outlined, and this is great. So, you know, I've read about what causes heart attacks. So the plaque, if the plaque is only accumulating there and the plaque's not doing it, kind of how you've outlined in your book, and maybe we have more to talk about before we get to that, the heart, and correct me if I'm wrong in interpreting this, the heart essentially creates its own bypass as needed.
Yes. If you look at, and a great picture of this, again, is on Knut's website, heartattacknew.com, and it will be on ours, hopefully, very soon. The body is not so stupid. You see, I'm trained as a medical doctor, so I know the rap, you know, and I was an ER doctor for 10 years, so I know about heart attacks because I had, you know, 10 people a night come in with chest pain. So, you know, I'm familiar with the whole thing. One of the problems with medical education is we tend to have this stupid body theory, like people, you know, their bodies break down because they're stupid and they're defective and all this. And that's rarely the case. You know, in fact, one of my favorite sayings from medical school, and sometimes I say it's the only thing I still remember from medical school, was the first day the doctor's guy gets up there and he says, "Just remember, the dumbest kidney is smarter than the smartest nephrologist," which is a kidney doctor, which is true. The body does not put all its eggs in those four artery baskets. That would be a serious design flaw. So the body makes an interweaving network of small vessels so that it's like a watershed instead of a river. And a watershed is much better at perfusing the tissue rather than a central river, because if the central river gets blocked, you're a goner.
Yep.
Whereas if you have all these small vessels, you essentially do your own bypass, and a blocked vessel is not a big deal. So that's why we have this, the body is always putting in redundant systems because it's an amazing design if seen properly. And interestingly, a coronary angiogram where they put the dye in, because it's heavy metal dye under high pressure, creates an artifact which makes the narrowing look bigger, and it doesn't show up these small vessels. So eventually people think they don't exist. I mean, it's sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, but they do exist. And that's why you don't have to worry so much about these particular blockages in one vessel. It's more of a flow problem than a blockage in one vessel. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that...
You did. Yeah. So have we answered the question yet of what causes heart attacks? You just alluded to a flow problem. Is that...
So here's the sequence of events which explains every observable phenomena that leads to a heart attack. It's actually very clear. Again, it's completely spelled out in my book. So the first thing that happens, we have a autonomic nervous system, which is separated into two branches, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Sympathetic is fight or flight. Parasympathetic is rest and digest. Life is good. In over 90%, even sometimes up to 95% of cases, the parasympathetic tone of a person who has heart disease is low. And this can come from physical or emotional stress. Smoking lowers your parasympathetic tone. Taking certain drugs does. Diabetes does. Inflammation does. Lots of things do. So you have low parasympathetic tone. You can demonstrate this on a heart rate variability monitor. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is you have a sympathetic stress, which could be emotional, physical, or a whole bunch of other things, too much exertion, or your wife leaves you, or your son gets in a car accident, whatever. And that creates an even worse imbalance. Now, just to say, if your parasympathetics are fine, humans are meant to, you know, to process, you know, stressful events. That's fine. But if your parasympathetics are low, then the next step happens, which is what's called a glycolytic shift. A glycolytic shift means normally the heart makes its fuel from burning fats and from the mitochondria. So that makes a lot of fuel, and it's very clean burning. But when the sympathetic nervous system gets activated in the face of a parasympathetic decrease, you have what's called a glycolytic shift, which means you go into glycolysis, which means you ferment fuels to make sugar. It's very inefficient, and you make lactic acid as a byproduct. It's the same thing that happens in your leg if you run more than you can. You go into glycolysis or anaerobic fermentation. Everybody knows about that. You build up lactic acid, and you get pain and cramps in your leg, right? That's what happens. The difference in the heart is your leg can stop, but your heart can't. And that creates an acidification of the tissue because of the lactic acid buildup in the heart cells. When lactic acid builds up, the tissue becomes more acidic, and that creates the situation where the calcium can't get into the cells and make the heart cells contract. And so they get what's called dyskinetic or atonic, which is what you see on a stress test. You see the heart not moving properly. So that's the next thing that happens. When the heart doesn't move properly and the lactic acid builds up, you get a localized necrosis or breakdown of the tissue. So first there's pain from the lactic acid, then there's necrosis or breakdown of the tissue, and that's what we call a heart attack.
Wow. So let me ask you this. The chest pain that people come to the ER with, is that the early stage there, that lactic acid part that you're talking about, or where are they typically along this chain?
They are building up lactic acid just like in your leg, and they're getting a cramp in their heart just like you get a cramp in your leg. And that's on the road if it continues to acidifying the tissue even more and causing it to die, which is what we then call a heart attack.
Wow.
Now, there's a final thing that happens, which is because of this movement imbalance in the muscle, the arteries are subjected to shear pressure, which then breaks off little pieces of the clots in the arteries, and that's the clots that the cardiologists see in your arteries. So that's a consequence of this happening, not the cause. But the central event is this buildup of lactic acid, acidification, and then necrosis or breakdown of the tissue. That has been shown to happen in literally 100% of people with angina or unstable angina or heart attacks.
Wow. Now, so when we're talking about something like AFib or atrial fibrillation, is that another cause or another manifestation of this imbalance between the parasympathetics and sympathetics?
So atrial fibrillation or arrhythmias are somewhat different. I mean, it's sort of completely different, but atrial fib is from chronic poor metabolism in the heart. So yes, you have this chronic situation of too much fermentation, glycolysis, not a healthy energy flow in the heart. And so it tends to be essentially electrically go its own way. And that's what we see is atrial fibrillation.
Interesting.
So it's a variation of this.
Okay.
I just want to point out that when we talked about strophanthus wobbeine earlier, so what does strophanthus wobbeine do? It is a specific internal hormone or endogenous hormone, meaning it's made in our adrenal glands. It goes from the adrenal glands to the coronary circulation, and it converts the lactic acid into pyruvate, which is a preferred fuel for the heart. So let me put that in clearer terms. The central chemical modulator of this breakdown in the pain is lactic acid. What strophanthus wobbeine does is it converts lactic acid into a fuel so your heart can burn it, and that breaks the cycle, and you don't get pain or acidification of the tissue. There's nothing else that does that, and that is a central breaking of this crucial sequence of events that leads people to heart attacks.
Wow. Now, let me restate that just to be clear. So you're saying before you add this plant into your body, you're saying your adrenal glands make this already. We're just adding in extra.
Yes, exactly. That's been proven by radioisotope studies.
That is incredible.
It's not only that, but ironically, not so much if anybody knows anything about this, it's actually wabain is made in us, in our adrenal cortex, from cholesterol. No surprise there, because it's a hormone, like substance, and all the hormones are made from cholesterol. And not only that, but the synthesis of wabain from cholesterol is specifically inhibited by statin drugs, the very drugs people are given to prevent heart attacks. And if that isn't the ultimate irony of ironies, it's probably not the ultimate one, because there are other ones, but it's one of the biggies.
It's up there, without a doubt. That is mind-blowing. So can this process be reversed if someone has been on a statins, just like with, let's say, melatonin supplementation, for example, and you downregulate production? Can you begin to support the adrenals and that natural production come back up if, let's say, the statin was removed from the picture and people transition from a low-fat to a more Weston A. Price-style diet? Can this process be reversed?
To a certain extent, although I must say, in some ways, I don't take my chances. So if you come to me and you've having chest pain or you've had a heart attack, I give you strophanthus, I would say, a little sheepishly, I'll say this, kind of for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Because my experience as of yet, after 10, 15 years of doing it, I still don't know of anybody who properly taking strophanthus wabain has had a heart attack. Now, and these are people who come to me post-bypass, they've, you know, they're, some of them can't walk to the mailbox, et cetera. So they're not like spring chickens either. So you give them strophanthus, you put them on a, you know, low inflammatory, high good fat, you know, no processed sugar. You have them, you know, do a exercise program with resistance training and strength training, you know, sort of high intensity, all that stuff. You know, it's all outlined in my book. And you do EECP if you need to, which helps stimulate more capillary flow formation in the heart. And that's how you protect their heart. Now, whether if you get them off statin drugs and put them on the diet, will they make more wabain? I sort of don't stick around to find out.
I don't blame you.
Well, I can see doing that, but I don't do it.
I think we have answered that question. So we have answered what causes heart attacks. It's basically this nervous system imbalance. So since you began practicing medicine, the invention of the iPhones happened. Do you think now,
yes,
which I think it's kind of a dumb question to ask you, but I'm going to ask it anyway, this problem of this parasympathetic-sympathetic balance, not only has it been altered since the Industrial Revolution from using the ancestral lens where we probably would have been in a parasympathetic mode more often, it seems like that's exponentially gotten worse over the last 20 years, wouldn't you say?
Yes, you're exactly right.
So what does that mean for people?
Ancestral people didn't have heart attacks. There's no doubt of that.
So
doesn't matter how long they lived, they did not have heart attacks. Didn't happen really until the 40s, late 30s, 50s in this country.
Okay. Let me ask you this. I've read about the nervous system, and I find that I geek out and I love reading about the nervous system the most. If you're a hunter-gatherer and we're 50,000 years ago, you and I are walking in the African savanna together, and we're walking and we're looking for a meal, are we parasympathetic dominant at that point? Are we sympathetic dominant, or is it just a balance?
It's a balance, but the best I can figure is it's a balance, but you're parasympathetic dominant with your sympathetic system ready. So like if a bear, you know, and I guess there's no bears in Africa, but whatever comes up, you better start running.
Okay, sure.
Or whatever you do. But you can't be inert. So you have to have a nervous system that can get you as activated as possible, including, you know, change your blood flow, narrow the vessels, shunt the blood away from your internal organs. You don't need to eat, digest your meal at that point. You need to run and think. And that's what the sympathetic system does. And we're perfectly meant to do that. That's not a problem. That doesn't cause heart attacks. It's a problem if you don't get away, I guess.
But right.
If you get away, you're good. I mean, that's what people did.
Sure.
And it, you know, there's emotional griefs in life. That's fine. But what's not fine is a life of chronic, unrelenting, physical, emotional, financial, you know, toxic stress, which is what, you know, modern life is all about.
Wow. I think I was born in the wrong generation.
Yeah, I would love to go, you know, live with native people myself, but
I fantasize because, you know, I live in Kentucky and I just fantasize reading about the Cumberland Gap and how Kentucky used to be considered the West. I mean, that's mind-blowing to me. And to think that someone had to cut through this little path in the Appalachian Mountains to get to the West, which is Kentucky, and then now you're in San Francisco, and that's the West. You know, that's completely mind-blowing.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
So just to be clear, you would say that generally operating through life, we want to do things that are going to nourish and put us in more of a sympathetic, dominant state. Now, you're not going to be passing out...
Parasympathetic.
Sorry. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Parasympathetic state. And because I've read, like in a sauna book, for example, I read, don't do the sauna. I have an infrared sauna. It says, don't do the sauna if you're turning the lights off, because that will engage the parasympathetic nervous system and you could faint upon standing. But isn't that the opposite of what I want? I don't want to be having the light on and stressing the sympathetics during the sauna. Don't I want to be engaging my parasympathetic and resting and breathing?
Yes, but you don't want to faint either. So.
Exactly.
Yeah, so as long as you're not fainting, you're fine.
Okay.
The other main important part of the book, in some ways more important for me, is going through just how the circulation works and what the heart actually does. And I don't think we have time for that today, but that's something that puts this whole thing in a context that I really try to develop a picture of all things heart related so people really could get a clear understanding of, you know, what the circulation is doing and what the heart is doing and why the heart gets sick and then what they can do about it, which is, you know, all these things we talked about.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. Just a couple last clarifying questions before I let you go, and we'll send people back to your website. We'll have all the links for that on the show notes. That'll be at notjustpaleo.com/Cowan. That's C-O-W, like cow, Cowan, A-N, notjustpaleo.com/Cowan. They'll be able to get your book directly through your website and order it there. And I loved it. I read it in one sitting or two sittings, and I couldn't put it down. I was sad when the book was over. I was like, I wish this was 500 pages, not, you know, about 200 pages or so. Now, someone that is looking into exercise, they've read the exercise books, they're wanting to do high-intensity training. It's not to say that that's bad for them. That can be good for them. But if you knew that someone had a severe amount of emotional trauma, emotional grief, let's say deaths, divorce, all of that, would you recommend somebody go into a high-intensity exercise, or would they need to start some type of, let's say, forest bathing, grounding, meditation-style lifestyle approach before they transition into bringing the high-intensity exercise on board?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So I think, you know, if you're talking about, and let's be clear, if we're talking about somebody with heart disease whose life is a mess, they need guidance from somebody who's done this before. So I would hesitate to say that person should do anything, because what they really should do is find somebody who can help them.
Agreed.
Now, I am perfectly aware that if what we mean by that is somebody who can help them with proper exercise like you just outlined and proper diet and strophanthus, etc., you know, as my grandson has often said, good yuck with that, because there aren't many people who can do that. It sounds like you have a good handle on the movement exercise part, and I totally agree with what you just said.
Sure. Okay, so you would say they would need, let's pull heart disease out of
guidance.
The question then.
They need guidance.
Okay, so let's take the heart disease layer off of this Jane Doe that we've outlined. They're just somebody in their 30s. They don't have any heart issues. They've already got the diet piece in order, but yet they have a severe amount of stress. Let's say they're working 70, 80 hours a week. They hate their job. They have some symptoms that alarm them. Maybe there are some adrenal issues. Does that someone need to get the nervous system in balance, I guess, is the more direct question I should have asked. Do they need to get the nervous system in check first before they try to go do their next CrossFit workout to try to burn off this stress that's built up through the work week?
They need to quit their job and get a new life.
Okay.
Now, that's easy for me to say, you know, like, but somehow, you know, it's like the question. So Doc, I'm going to do all these bad things, and then what should I do that's good for me?
Right.
So the answer is stop doing that. Well, I mean, this is your life. Like, you don't get another chance at this. I mean, maybe you do in some way, but forget. I don't want to talk about that right now.
Sure.
Because I don't know much about that. Let's just say you get this one chance to spend it doing a job you hate and a work you don't agree with. That's not a way to live your life.
Absolutely. Okay. So this is just a wisdom question then, and then I'll let you go here. It sounds like you have to have the foundations in order. There's different therapies. There's different places you can go with this conversation, but you have to, it sounds like enjoying life is kind of a prerequisite for all of this. There's no out supplementing or out medicine that you can do if the lifestyle is full of resentment and anger and anxieties and fears and all of that.
And is that
a safe statement?
Food. Yeah, absolutely. And tasteless, crappy food as well.
Yes.
Who wants that life? I mean, so, right. And we have a lot of work to do as a culture to, that's the normal life. And we're the lucky ones because we have it better, I think, than the people in Bangladesh, maybe.
Sure.
But that's, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, we'll let you go. I really appreciate your time. This has been so fun. Thanks for allowing me to put you through a little bit of topic whiplash here. I think we've really covered this in great detail.
Okay. And again, if we could just, I just want to put in we're going to form this website called humanheartcosmicheart.com. And we're really hoping that people will buy the book from us so we can help to get the word out on what we can do collectively to stop this heart disease craziness in this country.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Take care.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, I hope you enjoyed this episode with Dr. Cowan. Check out his book. You can go to my website, notjustpaleo.com/Cowan. You can check out the show notes, the couple different resources. You got to read about this Wabain. This stuff is amazing. His friends, the Heart Attack New website, is also another incredible resource, and you can read about how the heart naturally does its own bypass and things like that. So this is just a real eye-opener for me in the cardiac field. As always, I'm available a couple hours a month for complimentary consults, 15 minutes, where you and I can chat about your health symptoms. Thousands of people have gone before you. Now it's your turn. Get your health questions answered. Don't suffer anymore. I promise it's not necessary. Schedule that 15-minute free call back on my website, notjustpaleo.com, and I'll talk with you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye. He acts like it's all good, yeah, like everything's cool. Kiss her good and then he leaves her. She doesn't have a clue that he's terrible news. Why I'm in the tire, got to watch out, girl. Don't wanna see her cry her eyes out, girl. Cause I've been watching, you've been hurting. Let me be there.
the one that loves you better.